thoughtfully.
My husband and I aren't drinkers, but I guess I could go out and get some beer for the slugs. Do you know what brand? I don't think it matters. I'd get whatever's on sale. All right, I'll do that, said Mrs. Kimball. She opened her magazine again to the incendiary 4 o'clocks, but then closed it right back up, holding the place with her finger. You ought to try to keep in touch with your sister, she told me. Young people think nothing will ever happen. You should treasure your family while you have it. Well, really, I don't have it, I said, resentful of her assumptions. It's gone. My mother died when I was little, and my father will probably be dead before the year's out, and my baby died, and now my sister is dead too. Maybe I'm not as young as you think. Mrs. Kimball looked stunned. Your sister? The one on the phone? She got killed by the Contras, the ones down there that we send all the money to. I think you probably heard about it. She looked uneasy. I don't know. I might have. It made the news in Tucson, at least for a day. You just forgot. That's the great American disease. We forget. We watch the disasters parade by on TV, and every time we say, forget it. This is somebody else's problem. I suppose I was going, as Rita Cardinal would say, mental. I didn't look at Mrs. Kimball, but I could see her magazine drift slowly to her lap. I looked at the bright garden on the magazine cover and felt strangely calm. They kidnapped her one morning in a cotton field, I said. They kept her as a prisoner for weeks and weeks, and we kept hoping, but then they moved everybody to another camp, and some of the prisoners they shot. 8 of them. Hallie and 7 men. All of the men were teachers. They tied their hands behind them and shot them in the head and left their bodies all sitting in a line at the side of the road in a forest right near the border, all facing south. I felt a hard knot in my chest because this was the one image I saw most clearly. I still do. My voice sounded like a voice that would come from some other person's throat. Someone who had a dead sister and could speak of such things. The man that found them was driving up from Esteli, I said, coming along the road. And at first, when he saw them all sitting there, he thought, oh, that's too many. I can't give them all a ride. They won't fit in my truck. Mrs. Kimball and I didn't speak again after that. I looked out the window. Far to the south, low cone shapes pushed up against the flat, bright sky. Those distant mountains were probably in Mexico, I knew, though borders in this barren land seemed beside the point. I heard Mrs. Kimball turn a page of her magazine. We'd been silent for over an hour before she first spoke up about the 4 o'clocks, but the silence was much more noticeable now, after we'd broken it with our little conversation. Awareness is everything. Hallie once pointed out to me that people worry a lot more about the eternity after their death than the eternity that happened before they were born. But it's the same amount of infinity, rolling out in all directions from where we stand. My airplane was said to be bound for Denver, but it sat on the runway for a very long time. I had a window seat and could watch other planes lift their noses one after another and plow their way up an invisible road into the sky. I wasn't impatient. Normally, at this point in a flight, my heart would pound and my mouth would go to cotton, but today, my viscera were still. It didn't matter especially if we burned in a fiery crash. I thought maybe the air traffic controllers were trying to decide whether we were worth the trouble. We were only a small twin-engine plane, incompletely filled. A few seats ahead of me, a mother coached her preschooler who was already crying because he knew his ears would hurt when we went up. This was not the first leg of their trip. You swallow, honey. Just remember to swallow, and that makes your ears feel better. And yawn. I can't yawn. Sure you can. She demonstrated, her voice stretching wide over the yawn. Think about being real, real sleepy. People yawned all the way back to the smoking section. So strong was the power of motherly suggestion. I felt overcome with sadness. The aisle seat of my row was occupied by a teenager, and the empty seat between us was filling up with her overflow paraphernalia. She threw down a hairbrush and a curling iron, whack, whack, and pulled a substantial mirror out of a makeup case the size of my carry-on luggage. She began applying careful stripes of pastel eyeshadow. When she blinked, her eyelids waved like a pair of foreign flags.
"Give it a rest, Brenda," said the man sitting across the aisle. "You're not going to see your boyfriend for 10 whole days. Why not take this wonderful opportunity to let your face get some fresh air?"
Brenda ignored this advice, staring with deep absorption into her makeup mirror while her parents in B and C beamed her the evil eye. The mother was wearing a polka-dot jumpsuit with coordinated polka-dot earrings, all a little too eager-looking even for the first day of vacation. The man had on sunny golf pants that clashed with his disposition. It was hard to ignore them, but Brenda was practiced. She glanced serenely at her left wrist, which bore three separate watches with plastic bands in the same three shades as her eyeshadow. Her hair looked as if each strand had been individually lacquered and tortured into position. No matter how you might feel about the aesthetic, you had to admire the effort. Most people put less into their jobs.
"Brenda, honey, please pay attention when your father is talking to you," said the woman in the polka dots. "Could you please just try? Listening to you and your father bicker for a week and a half is not my idea of a vacation."
"You should have left me at home," Brenda said quietly, staring directly ahead.
"Honey, I think we forgot something. Did I leave the iron on?" "No, we forgot Brenda."
She shot me a glance, and I think I smiled a little. I couldn't help being on Brenda's side here. In my term as a schoolteacher, I'd gained sympathy for adolescents. If I had to take a trip with those two, I'd probably paint my face blue for spite. The plane jerked a little and then began to roll creakily down the runway, gathering speed. We were taking off without a warning announcement of any kind. "Flight attendants, prepare for takeoff," came out in a single scrambled burst over the intercom, and the women in pumps and dark suits ran as if from an air raid siren. I closed my eyes and laid my head back, trying to hold on to my visceral indifference, but it fell right away. My heart had caught up with me. I heard the little boy chattering to his mother, and I yawned nervously. So much of life is animal instinct. Desire and yawning and fear and the will to live. We left the earth and climbed steeply into the void. My habit was to count seconds during the liftoff, with my mind on news stories that ran along the lines of "crashed into a meadow only seconds after takeoff." Somewhere, I'd gotten the idea it took 7 minutes to get past imminent peril. I counted to 60 and started over. We'd been airborne maybe 3 or 4 minutes when our pilot's deep Texan voice came over the intercom. "Folks, I apologize for the delay in taking off today. We had trouble getting one of these cantankerous old engines started up." The announcement startled my eyes open. I looked at Brenda, who widened her eyes comically. "Great," she said.
"It's nice to know you're riding the friendly skies in a bucket of bolts," Brenda laughed. "Like my boyfriend's car."
"I think we'd be safer in your boyfriend's car."
"Not in their opinion," she said, inclining her head across the aisle.
I closed my eyes again. I tried to relax, but couldn't help listening to every change of pitch in the engine noise. They sounded wrong. Suddenly, I confided in Brenda. "I hate to fly, you know. It scares me to death." I hadn't admitted this aloud before and was surprised to hear it come out so naturally. The truth needs so little rehearsal. Brenda reached over and patted my hand.
"Folks, this is Captain Sampson. I'm sorry to report that we've lost that engine again."
Against my will, I glanced out at the wing to see if anything had actually fallen off. My heart beat hard and out of sync with itself, and I felt I might die of fright. I let the fingertips of my right hand lie across my left wrist, tracking the off-rhythm of my aimless heart. If I were really dying, I wanted to be the first to know.
After another minute, during which I imagined Captain Sampson and his co-pilot trying everything, his paternal drawl crackled on again. "We could probably make it to Stapleton on one engine," he said, "but we'll play it safe. We're going to turn around and head back into Tucson to see if they'll let us have some new equipment." I hated the sound of the word equipment. I had visions of men in coveralls running out to strap a spare engine onto the wing. If we made it back to the airport at all. Suddenly we banked so steeply my stomach turned. I must have looked pale because Brenda reached over and squeezed my hand again. "Try to think about something relaxing," she said. "Think about kissing your boyfriend." "That's relaxing?" I asked. She smiled. "No, but it takes your mind off." She was right. It did, for a second or two. I thought of Lloyd's last kiss on my doorstep in Grace, but it also made my chest ache, further distracting my heart from the task at hand. Nausea pressed on the back of my throat. I closed my eyes, but vertigo is an internal distress. Shutting out the world does nothing to help. The plane took another steep bank. We were in an unnatural position, vertical in the air and slipping down with nothing to support us. When we finally leveled out again, I opened my eyes. We were skimming low over Tucson, and I was comforted, irrationally, I know, by the nearness of things. Clusters of houses huddled together as if for reassurance, and in between them lay broad spans of flesh-colored desert. The freckled ground was threaded with thin branched lines of creeks, like veins in the back of a hand. It looked as if there were water in the creeks, although I knew better. At this time of year, they were bone-dry rivers of sand. The rush of adrenaline had rinsed me clean. I looked hard out the window and understood suddenly that what I saw was full of color. A watercolor wash of summer light lay on the Catalina Mountains. The end of a depression is that clear. It's as if you've been living underwater, but never realized it until you came up for air. I hadn't seen color since I lost Hallie. I thought hard, trying to remember. It seemed unbelievable, but there was none, almost none. Lloyd's green corduroy shirt and the red flowers and the hummingbird against the brightly lit wall, the moment Emelina said goodbye. And that was all. Before that, the last thing I clearly remembered in color was Santa Rosalia in its infinite shades of brown. I laughed at myself for carrying my mother's phobic blood in my veins and for telling Alice Kimball how to cure slugs, practicing all this family business without a license. It seemed extraordinary and accidental that I was alive. I felt crowded with all the sensory messages that make up life as opposed to survival, and I recognized this as something close to joy. As we slipped down over the city, every building and backlot was beautifully distinct. I forgot about my heart, left it to look after itself. We passed south of downtown, over the rail yard, where the boxcars stood in line looking sweet and mismatched like a child's toy put together with no eye for color coordination. Just past the rail yard was a school, where a double row of corn-colored school buses were parked in a ring, exactly like one of those cheap Indian necklaces made for tourists. Bright backyard swimming pools gleamed like turquoise nuggets. The land stretched out under me the way a lover would, hiding nothing, offering up every endearing southwestern cliché, and I wanted to get down there and kiss the dirt. I made a bargain with my mother. If I got to the ground in one piece, I wasn't leaving again. The Amtrak didn't depart until 3:30. I made it with time to spare. The station clerk wouldn't sell me a ticket to my destination, saying it wasn't a passenger stop. I argued. I knew the train stopped there for a crew change. Finally, I realized he could sell me a ticket for anywhere at all on the eastbound line. It didn't matter. I knew where I was getting off. We pulled out of the station and I hugged myself, cradled in the wide reclining seat, letting the rails rock me like a baby. The car smelled like smoke and old leather, I lay sideways in the seat, facing the window, my legs curled under me. Tucson, Arizona passed slowly enough to nod at, take notice of, and then let go. At a steady, measured pace, these things were revealed to me. The backs of brickyards, the backs of barrios, a large outdoor factory where Mexican women painted tiles. We passed buildings whose high walls, empty of windows, were spray-painted with huge secrets seen by no one but the travelers of the Southern Pacific. And then came the broad, open desert, mile after mile of it. I understood the appeal of train travel. You couldn't help knowing where you'd been. At some point, I fell asleep, and at some point, I woke up again. I felt I'd been on that train for the whole of my life. We approached Grace from a direction that was new to me. We didn't go by the junkyard. There was a tunnel through the granite cliffs, and we entered it fast, the dark rock wall magnifying the rocketing clamor of tons of forward motion. And then, quiet and sudden, out into the bright light again. I blinked against the overexposed world. By the time my eyes adjusted, we were right downtown, behind the old jailhouse, pulling the sighing brakes, slowing down. We came gliding under the long wooden porch of the depot. The sun glinted on its pleated tin roof, and I noticed a carob tree there with a trunk the size of a rain barrel. It must be the male, the mate to the one up by the liquor store, the one I'd been looking for. The conductor looked a little surprised when I pulled my bag off the rack and hopped down onto the concrete apron of the depot. "This isn't anywhere, sweetheart," he said, looking down at me from the doorway. He was a very old, very dark-skinned man whose uniform looked as if it could hold up its shoulders without him. "I know," I said. "You can't get back on," he warned. 10 minutes for a crew change and then we're headed out for El Paso." "I know. I don't want to get back on. I live here." "Well, how do you do?" he said. He stepped back into the car and waved at me through the window. His gloved hand fluttered like a dove. 100 yards up the line, I saw the fireman climb down the ladder from the engine. It was someone I'd gone to school with, Roger Bristol. Lloyd tossed down Roger's grip and his own, one at a time, and then swung himself easily down the ladder as if he were born for this work. He talked briefly with 2 other men, the oncoming crew, I guessed. They would speak in their magical language of dog catchers and sun kinks and the ones that had died on the line, picking up trains from the dead and moving on. They parted ways, and the new crew climbed into the engine. The other 2 men walked toward the depot carrying their grips and lunch buckets, one short and stocky, the other taller, broad-shouldered, with his hair in a ponytail. The people you love always look perfectly proportioned from a distance. Shortly the train began to move again, very slowly, the speed of a living creature. You could still run and catch it. Lloyd and Roger kept walking toward me without seeing me. Standing there watching him, knowing what he didn't, I had so much power and none at all. I was on the outside in a different dimension. I'd lived there always. Then he stopped dead, just for a second. I'll remember that. The train moved, and Roger moved, but Lloyd stood still. He caught up to me in an instant, with a twinkle in his eye, and his bag slung over his shoulder like a ready traveler. "Thanks for the ride," I said. He put 1 arm around my neck and gave me the kind of kiss no fool would walk away from twice. Chapter 26 The 50 Mothers. For several days, I kept coming back to this. We had no body. I wanted to have a funeral for Hallie, but I was at a loss. I knew the remains should not have been important, but in a funeral, the body gives the grieving a place to focus their eyes. We sit facing it, bear it on our shoulders, follow it down the road in procession, and finally long to follow it into the ground. the body would have provided an agenda and told me what to do, in lieu of Hallie, who was gone. I went to look for something else that in my mind stood for her. The Semilla Besada, one of the supernaturally blessed trees that in the old days were festooned like Christmas trees with the symbols of people's hopes. We could hold a funeral there, outside, under the leaves. I wanted to find the exact plum tree where we'd hidden a lock of our intertwined hair. I knew the orchard, but couldn't find the tree. Either it was gone, or it was no longer exceptional. Maybe the trees all around it had stretched their taproots and found the same nurturing vein. It was June, a week before Hallie's 30th birthday. The canopies were in full green, each one as brilliant as a halo. The blossoms had dropped and left behind incipient fruits, swelling 3 and 4 to a cluster, not yet pruned by nature or by hand. Every tree in every orchard looked blessed. So we had the funeral there, in the old Domingos plum orchard. I'd asked people to bring something that reminded them of Hallie. I spread the black and red afghan on the ground, and we stood around that. Instead of decorating a tree with our hopes for the future, we decorated a blanket with icons from the past. All the women from Stitch and Bitch were there, and JT and Emelina, of course, and Lloyd. All of my students as well. Doc Homer didn't make it. He didn't go very far out of his house these days, or very far out of his head. It was awkward getting started. I remembered the last time I'd hugged her, thinking I could hold on and stop our lives right there. I took some breaths. Hallie asked to be buried in Nicaragua, I said. She wanted that, to enrich the soil of a jungle, but I wanted something here, too. I stopped because it sounded to me like small talk. Words only cover the experience of living. I looked around at the unpretentious faces like slices of bread, all the black dresses, the dark shoes, and I looked up at the bright leaves lit from above. It was a brilliant, hot day, and I didn't feel at all like crying. The black dresses made me think of Greece. Nothing seemed quite real. Several peacocks had gathered in the trees behind our heads, keeping their distance, but curious, probably hoping for food. A peacock wouldn't know the difference between a picnic and a funeral. The outward signs were similar. "Do you think we should sing?" I asked. "Yes," said Emelina. "We ought to sing." "What?" I couldn't think of any particular song that Hallie liked, except some silly things from our teenage years. Mother and Child Reunion and Maggie May. I thought of Hallie moonwalking to Thriller, and then I thought abstractly about never seeing her again, what that really meant. In the back of my mind, I was still wondering when she would come home. I couldn't concentrate. Someone suggested "Let the Circle Be Unbroken," so we sang that, and then we sang "De Colores" because everybody knew it. Norma Galvez's husband, Cassandro, played the guitar. Then it was quiet again. People shifted slightly on their feet, the same motion repeated many times throughout the crowd, like the dancers at Santa Rosalia, except unconscious and unrehearsed. I pulled some letters out of my pocket and read parts of them that Emelina had helped me pick out. I read what Hallie said about not wanting to save the world, that you didn't choose your road for the reward at the end, but for the way it felt as you went along. And I read some things she'd said about nations forgetting, refusing to sell tractor parts, then wondering why people would turn to Yugoslavia for tractors. I was aware that my reading might seem a little rambling, but I felt there was some logic to it, and people were tolerant. Truly, I think they would have listened to me all day. It occurred to me that such patience might be the better part of love. I read a quote she'd written me that seemed important, a thing said by Father Fernando Cardinal, who was in charge of the literacy crusade. "You learn to read so you can identify the reality in which you live, so that you can become a protagonist of history rather than a spectator. I waited a minute while a peacock screamed. Then I read some words of Halley's. The very least you can do in your life is to figure out what you hope for. And the most, another peacock suddenly howled nearby. I saw Emelina's twins craning their necks, trying to spot it. I went on. And the most you can do is live inside that hope. What I want is so simple I almost can't say it. Elementary kindness. Enough to eat. Enough to go around. The possibility that kids might one day grow up to be neither the destroyers nor the destroyed. I finished by reading the letter from Sister Sabina Martin. She said thousands of people joined us in mourning Halley. I know that doesn't make your grief any smaller, she wrote, but I believe it makes Halley's presence larger. Certainly, she won't be forgotten. Several peafowl had hopped to the ground and were making insistent guttural noises, impatient for food. I saw Glenn and Curtis sneak off into the trees in pursuit of a peacock they'd never catch. This is what I brought. I knelt by the Afghan and set down a pair of Halley's small black shoes, about second grade size. They could have been mine. It was impossible to tell, but I said they were Halley's. I put them in the center of the red and black crocheted blanket. I brought these, I said, because they just reminded me of growing up with Halley. We had to wear these ugly shoes. It was just one of the important things we did together. I don't know. We felt kind of alone sometimes. I stood up and looked at the trees through the curtain of water in my eyes. Viola laid down some marigolds. She had on her polyester, the funeral dress for all seasons, and she was perspiring. Broad, damp spots underlined her bosom. Whenever I think of you kids, I think of the Cempasúchiles and being up at the graveyard for All Souls. You were always a very big help. I looked at Viola. She stared back, rubbing the bridge of her nose. There was the faintest light of a smile. Several women had things they claimed we'd left in their houses when we played there as children. A doll with unpleasant glass eyes and a gruesomely pockmarked head where its hair had come out. A largish plastic horse. A metal hen that, when you pushed her down on her feet, made a metallic cluck and laid a small marble egg. Also, a pink sweater, size 6X. Mrs. Nunez swore it was Halley's. It was behind the refrigerator. I didn't find it till last year when the refrigerator gave out and we had to call the man to move it out and get us a new one in there. The dust, I hate to tell you, but there was this little sweater of Halimita Nolin's. She used to set up there on top of the refrigerator because I told her she couldn't drink beer till she was as tall as her daddy. This was the truth, dead center. I remembered her up there huddled among the mason jars and bright cracker boxes. I stared at the freshly laundered pink sweater lying with outstretched arms and thought about how small Halley had been at one time. Miss Calder and Miss Dan were just then displaying an ancient-looking picture book, but there was a roaring in my ears and I lost track of what they were saying. I believe it was the physical manifestation of unbearable grief. But you learn in these situations that all griefs are bearable. Lloyd was standing on one side of me and Emelina on the other, and whenever I thought I might fall or just cease to exist, the pressure of their shoulders held me there. I could hear people's words, but my vision was jarred by showers of blue sparks. Or the world went out of focus. And at other times I could see but couldn't hear. Doña Altea clumped forward with her cane and set down a miniature, perfectly made peacock piñata. It perched there on the pile of childhood things, its small eyes glittering and its tail feathers perfectly trimmed. It was an exquisite piece of art that could have made it into Mr. Reinhardt's gallery, but it was for Halley. I tried to listen to what she was saying. She said, I made one like this for both of you girls for your cumpleaños when you were 10. To my surprise, this was also true.
I remembered every toy, every birthday party, each one of these 50 mothers who'd been standing at the edges of my childhood, ready to make whatever contribution was needed at the time.
Gracias, abuelita, I said softly to Doña Altea as she clumped away.
She didn't look at me, but she heard me say it, and she didn't deny that she was my relative. Her small head, crowned with its great white braid, nodded a little. No hugs or confessions of love. We were all a little stiff, I understood that. Family constellations are fixed things. They don't change just because you've learned the names of the stars. Yuda Dell went last. I brought this bouquet of zinnias because every spring Hallie helped me dig my zinnia bed. She laid down the homely particolored bouquet and added, I crocheted that afghan too.
You did?
She looked at me surprised. Right after your mommy died. Well, I don't guess you'd remember. This blanket got us through a lot of tough times, I said. I was feeling a little more steady on my feet. I folded in the corners and drew it all up into a bundle against my chest. About everything Hallie and I had ever done was with us there in the Domingos orchard. Everything we'd been, I was now. Thank you, I said to everybody. I turned my back and headed alone with my bundle up the old pony road to Doc Homer's house.
Homero.
Chapter 27, Human Remains. There are women in every room of this house, he thinks. Mrs. Quintana upstairs, and now there is Cody, standing in the kitchen with her baby. Her arms and chest clutch the black wool bundle, and it weighs her down like something old, made of stone. The weight makes him want to turn away. He thinks, this is the fossil record of our lives. I'm going to bury this. Do you want to help me? She looks up at him, and tears stream down. The grief on her face is fresh as pollen.
You already buried it.
No, 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 she screams and slams the screen door behind her. He follows her down the path, but she doesn't go down to the riverbed this time. She turns and goes right around the house into the backyard. When he catches up, a little breathless, she is standing with her boots on the ground like rooted stalks, standing beside the old plot where Hallie used to grow a garden. A few old artichoke bushes have gone thistly and wild around its perimeter. Cody drops the knotted bundle and goes to the tool shed to retrieve a shovel. She comes back and digs hard into the ground. It hasn't been disturbed for many years.
Are you sure this is a good place? He asks.
Without speaking, she steps on the shovel, and its tip bites into the sandy soil again and again, lifting, digging, and lifting out a deep square hole.
You might want to have a garden here again someday, when this house is yours.
The shovel stops suddenly. Did you know I'm staying? She looks at him. He looks back, waiting. I told Lloyd about the baby. Yesterday, I took him down there to the riverbed where you showed me. I can remember every minute of that night. You gave me some pills, didn't you? You really did want to help. She looks up at the sky, using gravity and the small twin dams of her eyelids to hold in tears. So Lloyd knows about that now. He's sad. I didn't think about that part, that he would be sad. I was thinking the baby was just mine.
It wasn't just yours.
I know. She wipes her cheeks with the back of her hand, leaving a faint dark smudge under each eye. She looks at him very oddly. We might have another one, Lloyd and I. I don't know. There's time to see.
Yes.
Did you know I'm a good science teacher? The kids and the teachers all voted. They say I'm spirited. How do you like that?
It's what I would expect.
I'm teaching them how to have a cultural memory. She looks at her hands and laughs, but looks sad. I want them to be custodians of the earth, she says. He also looks at her hands. They remind him of something. Whose hands? You really can't approve of me staying, can you? She demands, suddenly angry. You raised me to turn my back on this place. That worked for you, but the difference is you knew it was really your home. You knew you had one, so you had a choice. That's all very well and good, he says. But you still might want a garden. These artichoke bushes still produce. Every summer they bloom as if their hearts depended on it. Never mind that there was nobody taking in the harvest. He takes the tip of a silvery leaf between his fingers. It looks knife-like, but is yielding and soft. She looks at him for quite a long time, smiling, and then she looks down at the bundle. It's all right to bury this here, she says. There are no human remains. No human remains. No human remains. The three words chime in his head like large old bells. Three descending notes that ring and ring, speeding up in tempo until they clang against one another. How true, he says finally. She shaves out the edges of the hole so it is neat and square, and then drops the bundle in. She throws a handful of dirt on top of it and stands there looking down. We're a pair of scarred old souls, aren't we, Cody? I don't know what we are. I'm trying to figure out what I hope for. It's a most dangerous thing, hope. Her eyes flash with something bright. Love or anger, but she doesn't speak. Hope involves giving a great deal of yourself away, he tells her. That's a pitiful excuse. Oh, it's pitiful, all right, but there you have it. It's hard to give much away when you're the subject of widespread disapproval and your heart is leaking from puncture wounds. That's true. We got punctured pretty bad, but we still gave the world a lot, Pop. We gave it Hallie. We did. We surely did. She begins shoveling dirt back into the grave. He thinks about the fact that all these particles of dirt have now been rearranged. No fixed strata. Alice was the gardener. When she has finished, she moves to his side and he takes her elbow. They stand side by side in their small garden of sand and buried children. The bones in his wife's arm are as thin as whistles. Do you have any idea how much I love you? He asks her. She stares at him, then squeezes his hand. Hallie was a protagonist of history, she says. She wanted to save the world. No, Pop, that's not true. She wanted to save herself, just like we all do. He looks at the tall, living daughter his wife has suddenly become. He is no longer angry about these changes. Save herself from what? From despair? From the feeling of being useless? I've about decided that's the main thing that separates happy people from the other people. The feeling that you're a practical item with a use, like a sweater or a socket wrench. He asks, are we the other people? He is curious. You're not useless. You gave yourself to this town for 40 years, scarred soul or not. Yes, but I gave for the wrong reasons, as you have pointed out. She laughs. I did, didn't I? Damn. She pulls at the end of a silver artichoke leaf. I was scared to death I was going to grow up to be just like you. She looks at him and laughs again. She says, God, I could never be just like you. They are standing in the garden, in a dwarf forest of artichokes. She has just dug a hole and buried God knows what, and now has made a confession of either contempt or admiration. He waits to see what will happen next. Maybe the reason you gave yourself to this town doesn't matter that much. Maybe what matters is just that you did it. Maybe that makes you a good man. You know what Lloyd told me one time?
No.
He thinks people's dreams are made out of what they do all day. The same way a dog that runs after rabbits will dream of rabbits. It's what you do that makes your soul, not the other way around. It's what you do that makes your soul. Standing opposite him, staring down into the grave, he sees two sad little girls in cowboy hats. Is this what he has done? I don't think you should be here, he says to them. The elder daughter looks up, her pale eyes steady. But we are here, Papa. Yes, you are. Why don't you want us? Oh, God, I do. He kneels down and takes them both in his arms and pulls them against his chest. He understands for the first time in his life that love weighs nothing. Oh, God, his girls are as light as birds. Cosima. Chapter 28. Day of All Souls. Gracela Canyon, if you strip it down to the enduring things, is a great granite bowl of air. It's a wonderful echo chamber. Voices of women and children in the cemetery reached Viola and me from all the way across the canyon, rising on invisible air currents with the ravens and the spirits of all those old bones being tended by their children. It was getting on toward late afternoon, and we walked slowly. Viola had spent the morning supervising family operations and said she was tired. But she'd promised that any day I asked her, she would take me to the place where we watched my mother go. I chose that particular day, in 1989, the end of a decade, the Day of All Souls, when we were all up decorating the graves. I don't know why. I'd finished sweeping off my father and the other Nolinas and had decked them out with little bunches of marigolds at their heads and feet. It was something like tucking children into bed. I was their historian and their guardian angel. I never found Ursulina, the little bear. I imagine she's somewhere closer to the mine, where the earth has been shifted too many times to bear witness to what it has buried in it. The rest of the family, for all the times they'd had to be exhumed, has stayed together surprisingly well. I knelt all morning in the dirt, laying out a border of creek rocks around Doc Homer. He'd been gone more than 2 years, but it took me a while to decide on this. Emelina's boys had hauled the rocks up there for me. When we took them out of the water and piled them into the wheelbarrow, they lost their luster, all drying to the same whitish color of dust, and I was afraid after all that work they would be the wrong thing, but they were fine. Uniform and shipshape, washed smooth by the abrasion of natural forces. I laid them end to end around the dirt mound, knocking them together and working them back and forth a little to find a natural fit. As I worked, I thought of the masonry walls of Kanishba, with the bones of children inside. When I stood back, finally, and dusted my chapped hands against my jeans, I saw I'd achieved nothing so fine as Kanishba, but had marked out a clear boundary anyway. He would like it. I'd brought some order to his cosmos, finally. I squinted into the sun. Across the tops of about 100 gravestones and many people, I saw Viola in her black dress, standing on a little rise, her gray hair wandering from its knot. She pressed one hand to the small of her back while Mason and Nicholas danced in front of her with their hands full of candy, begging for something, wearing her out. Nicholas was 3 1/2. John Tucker was talking about quitting school to be a hoghead for Southern Pacific. I thought, I can't wait forever. So I went and asked her right then, and she said, fine, after lunch we would go. I'm about done here, she'd said, cracking the sugar skull of a calavera between her molars. They can figure out which end of the flowers to put in water without me. We took the quickest road down into town, then cut across the hill behind the high school and through the splendid canopies hung with fruit that the Stitch and Bitch Club had won back from Black Mountain Mining. From there,
we headed up the old pony road toward the abandoned mine. The tops of the flat tailing mounds were dimpled with rain-catching basins, and I'd noticed that sprigs of rabbit brush were starting to grow up there. The road was steep. No route out of Grace was an easy climb. Twice I had to ask Viola to let me catch my breath. I held a fist to my breastbone, panting hard, a little embarrassed by my infirmity, but also a little pleased by the external proof of what was still mostly an internal condition. I was pregnant. I feel like I don't have any energy. I come home from school and sleep till Lloyd wakes me up for dinner, and then I go back to bed. This new relationship with sleep was a miracle to me. "Oh, yeah," she said. "All your get up and do it goes to the baby, right from the start. You know who's going to be the boss." Those first few weeks are an unearthly season. From the outside, you remain so ordinary, no one can tell from looking that you have experienced an earthquake of the soul. You've been torn asunder, invested with an ancient, incomprehensible magic. It's the one thing we never quite get over, that we contain our own future. I'd written this to Hallie in the pages of a bound notebook that would never be torn out or mailed. These letters stayed with me. I told her, it feels like somebody's moved in. It's a shock. You find you're not the center of the universe. Suddenly, it's all flipped over. You have it in you to be a parent. You're not all that concerned anymore with being someone's child. It helps you forgive things. We reached the crest of the canyon where the white salt crust of the old alfalfa fields began. Dead for two decades, the earth was long and white and cracked, like a huge porcelain platter dropped from the heavens. But now the rabbit brush was beginning to grow here, too, topped with brushy gold flowers, growing like a renegade crop in the long, straight troughs of the old irrigation ditches. A wind was picking up from the south, and Viola and I could smell rain. High storm clouds with full sails and a cargo of hail made their way in a hurry across the sky. Viola's hair blew around her face as she walked. I asked, "Did you know her kidneys had failed her once before, when she was pregnant with me?" "Sure," Viola said. "She was real sick both times." "But she went ahead and had Hallie anyway." "You don't think about it that much. You just go on and have your kids." I wanted to believe my mother had thought about it, that Hallie was her last considered act of love, an act with unforeseen consequences, some of them just now coming into flower in the soil of another country. I said, "I always knew I was up here that day. I can remember seeing the helicopter." "You remember that?" "I thought I did. But people told me I hadn't, so I'd about decided I'd made it up." Viola took my hand. I could feel the soft flesh and the hard wedding band in her grip. "No, if you remember something, then it's true," she said. "In the long run, that's what you've got." I knew the place when we came to it. We were right there already. This is what I remember. Viola is holding my hand. We're at the edge of the field, far from other people. We stand looking out into the middle of that ocean of alfalfa. I can see my mother there, a small white bundle with nothing left. And I can see that it isn't a tragedy we're watching, really. Just a finished life. The helicopter is already in the air, and it stays where it is, a clear round bubble with no destination, sending out circular waves of wind that beat down the alfalfa. People duck down, afraid, as if they're being visited by a plague or a god. Their hair is blowing. Then the helicopter tilts a little, and the glass body catches the sun. For an instant, it hangs above us, empty and bright. And then it rises like a soul.
This is Barbara Kingsolver.
This production of Animal Dreams, presented by Harper Perennial and Harper Audio, was produced and directed by Rick Harris and recorded at Classic Recording Studio in Bristol, Virginia. Engineered by Mike Stevenson. Edited and mastered by Lance Neal. Executive producer, Jennifer Lopes. Text copyright 1990 by Barbara Kingsolver. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.